Hello, friends and listeners. I'd like to thank our sponsors, the Avery Hotel and Brasserie. Located in the heart of downtown is Boise's only historic boutique hotel, meticulously renovated by renowned chef Cal Elliott. The property boasts two unique restaurants, both anchored by 100-plus-year-old Brunswick bars. The Avery Brasserie, with a diverse French-inspired menu, and Tyner's Alley, with a dark and moody English pub vibe with scotch eggs and free pool. I've eaten at both, and let me tell you, they scrumptious. With beautiful soaking tub and balcony rooms and suites overlooking the historic gem block on 10th and Main Streets, you can find modern, elevated comfort and rich history perfect for visiting guests, staycations, and special occasions. And let me tell you, I've gotten my relaxation on in these rooms. Oh, soaking tubs, soaking my feet, eating some treats and drinking some cocktails. And it's historic, baby. Lots of crazy stuff happened in this hotel since its construction back in 1910. Find out more about the Avery at theaveryboise.com. People often say, history's boring. And I say, slow down. Pull your head out. Think a bit. History is a fundamental building block of civilization. And it's the way we describe our civilizations and the human condition within it. It can be so many different things, just as humans are so many different things. And so it can be fun, and it can be depressing. It can be funny, and it can be boring and dry. It can be many things, and often, whether you enjoy history or not is dependent on those telling the stories, the historians, those presenters of the past. And we think we can take you down the right road. Straight out of Boise, Idaho, we are the Highway to History Podcast. Join us. Thank you to the Trendy Dads out of San Francisco, California, for that wonderful cover of the B-52's Private Idaho. Hello, hello, hello. It is the Highway to History Podcast once again. Thanks for tuning in. We're trying to like really lean into our interests and strengths this episode. We got our... London has himself Coors Light cracked and ready to go. I have one in the chamber and one in my hand. I got a Yellow Belly, as I've been told it's called. I got the Banquet Beer Coors, my favorite. And then, you know, when we want to play it safe and be responsible, we drink the Coors Light. So anyway, it is getting close to October when we're recording just now. And so... the idea being this is going to come out in October. And so London and I are both fans of, well, film in general.
Yeah.
Historical films, you know, and then more so, we both love the horror genre. So London, tell us about what we're going to talk about and your idea for today's show.
Well, so kind of what you were saying, we're both really interested in film. And I think a lot of film is heavily, or even just stories, books, whatever, fiction is heavily inspired by reality and history. I think, you know, obviously movies like Gladiator or World War II films like Saving Private Ryan, like there's films that are obviously inspired by history, but something like horror, the horror genre, you wouldn't maybe expect as much, something like A Nightmare on Elm Street to have some sort of true inspiration for it. And I think that that's a really interesting thing to talk about, bringing horror and Halloween, you know, into reality and history. And so, you know, I think that's a topic we'll probably talk about a lot on this podcast, like how fiction influences reality and how reality influences fiction.
And also the psychology behind a horror and how people are like, oh, what does horror have to do with feminism? You'd be like, well, we have a guest.
Such a good point.
In the future that we'd like to talk about. But people are starting to take horror a little more seriously.
Mm. Horror has evolved so much.
Well, because it's all a conduit to express the human state, the human emotions that we all experience.
So true.
And, you know, so we're, you know, my point being, we'll get into feminism and horror in a future episode.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a lot you can do with horror.
Yeah, I mean, not just feminism. You could probably talk about so many societal issues or things that have to do with horror because, I mean, this probably applies to way more than just horror, but storytelling in general is like a reflection of our reality and our environment around
us.
Well,
right. I think we can all, you know, have felt like these days we're eating buckets of shit.
Yeah.
And so, like, when we talk about the human centipede, right?
Oh, God.
What is that really about, you know?
True. Yeah, no, straight up.
Do you come home with breath so bad you feel like you're... your mouth has been sewed to the asshole.
Or a movie, like, I think I've told you about this movie, The Platform, that kind of reminds me of that vibe, but it's very much commentary about capitalism and classism and stuff.
But it's not one person's mouth sewn to another person's ass.
No, but it's the reason it made me think of that is because it is kind of, there are some disturbing moments where you're like, this is very horrific, like in that scene.
Was that where they live in a prison kind of thing?
Yeah, like an elevator.
Right.
Yeah, that sends food down the elevator. It's on Netflix. It's a Basque movie. It's really, really cool. But I know, so since I thought the case that I just wanted to briefly talk about because it, you know, leads into so many other things in horror, I would argue that maybe the most influential horror film, at least in paranormal horror films, is The Exorcist.
Like, true.
I mean, people talk about that movie like I wasn't alive when it came out, but people talk about it like they were passing out in theaters. There were ambulances. I mean, people were like shook by what they saw. The head turning scene is super iconic. And I think that it's interesting. Probably most people don't know that there's some truth to that story.
That movie's literally head turning.
Yeah. Hey, you know what's interesting is I feel like people from my generation maybe don't think it's as scary because it so many movies have sort of grown from that or learned from that movie and expanded genre off of that movie, you know?
And I felt the same. Like, the most disturbing movie to me as a kid and still disturbs me is Aliens.
The second one?
Oh, that's the first one I saw.
Oh, okay.
And then Alien definitely messed with me.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and I'm like, holy crap, that is way more disturbing to me than The Exorcist.
Yeah,
but
I agree.
We used to be a more religious country in some ways too.
True.
Right, and
more fear.
I don't believe in a devil as you know, depicted in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think the more frightening aspects of that movie are what you hear before you actually see Regan become, you know, possessed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find like the thumpings in the attic, the strange happenings.
Yeah.
I find that totally fascinating.
You know, that, I mean, not to talk about the history of it, but that makes me think of with horror. I think a really good rule a lot of the time is that the audience's imagination is more powerful than anything you can actually show them. I don't think that's always true, but I think a lot of the times what ruins things for me in horror is when they show the monster or they show the demon or they show the alien. And that's not always true. Like, I think a movie like The Thing by John Carpenter does a really good job of just showing it. And like, your imagination couldn't have thought of that anyway. So it's so disturbing.
Well, in Alien, you know, both work. See, but the what do they call it? Like the prestige, like they call it magic.
Mm.
It has to sell.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when that alien finally busted through, it had to like be, and it looked the part.
Uh-huh.
And the face huggers, you know, it's like this thing's basically shoving its member down your throat and then in you know, putting eggs into you.
Yeah, it's like basically alien rape.
Right, right. And that's the most, that's what's so disturbing about it. And then this thing comes out of you, right?
Ugh, yeah.
So there's so many analogies you can make, but I mean, that was more disturbing to me than The Exorcist.
That's interesting. I mean, I actually read a list. I was preparing for this kind of like, what are the greatest horror films? Obviously, every list is fucking different, but one of the top lists had Alien number one as the greatest horror film of all time. I was like, I don't know if I personally agree with that, but that it definitely has the argument.
I feel that when you get to the top, you know, 10, you can switch them around.
Oh, 100. That's how it is on most of these lists,
right?
With anything, right?
But then you get like, you get these lists now and, you know, they're like greatest punk bands or greatest like horror movies.
Sure.
It's like, yeah, this is where I see my generation the difference. I'm like, that fucking movie? Come on. Yeah. Like, to me, The Conjuring should not be in the top five.
It's a fine movie.
Oh, God, are you kidding me? Not even close.
Right? But they have The Conjuring up there, you know? Just kind of, I know, man.
You know, I guess what would be an interesting list, because they do actually, this would be a super cool thing to, like, pull up for the pod, but they have had a thing that they studied, and maybe they do it every year, where they test people's heart rate watching horror films, and they determined what is the scariest, objectively, horror film.
Oh, right.
What film has the highest heart rate? And I'm going to get it wrong, but I think it might be Sinister, if you've ever seen Sinister.
Oh, that's a messed up movie.
Yeah, I think that movie might have been number one for like 2 years straight.
But it's also tension. Like, you know, some directors are great at just, you know, as far as a look is concerned, and just what I love as far as gothic, it's Coppola's Dracula.
Oh.
You know, I'm totally amazed by that movie. It's an eerie feeling, but it's not a jump scare.
And would that be still horror? Is that horror, or is that like...
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay, okay.
But then you'd have something like, you know, is it even horror? But as far as how I felt, like my heart beating, it's that end sequence of Jodie Foster in the basement in
Ooh,
Silence of the Lambs. Like, is that a horror movie? I've seen it classified as that.
Yeah, I think it is.
Or is it a thriller?
It's weirdly like a, thriller detective, but also... I wasn't very scared of that movie, actually, when I saw it. I thought it was a great... I walked away going, that was a great movie.
Precious.
Yeah, and yeah, the Buffalo Bill, which we'll get into that, and even, like, Anthony Hopkins is just fucking money in that movie.
Right.
You know? But I didn't feel, like, terrified watching that movie, necessarily, in the same way that you're saying Exorcist didn't scare you.
Well, it ended funny, too.
Yeah, no.
He's like, I'm having an old friend for dinner.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The world's a better place with you in it, Clarice.
Hannibal's a great character, but... So anyways, I don't even necessarily want to talk that much about it, but there's the Exorcist was based on this real exorcism that happened in the 40s, that they don't necessarily, I think they know the person's name. It was a young boy that they called Roland Doe, almost like Jane Doe, just like a pseudonym. The family doesn't really want to be identified or known, or the person who this was about doesn't really.
Not Doughy Roland.
Doughy Roland.
That's one of the worst porn star names ever.
Is that a real porn star?
No.
I was like, what?
Doughy Roland, you can't even find it.
Oh my God. Oh God, I see what you're saying.
Anyway, go ahead. Sorry,
I mean, Roland Doe, it's interesting that this is like a 14-year-old boy who they, you know, said is a victim of demonic possession, and they had, you know, a priest named Raymond Bishop came and, you know, he made all these supernatural claims and did these exorcisms on the kid. And there's claims that, like, in the exorcism, the bed is shaking and a levitation and a voice changing, like, deep. Like, all of a sudden he has this demonic voice. He's spitting on them. He's freaking out. He's just being super erratic and crazy. And a lot of these claims then kind of, I don't know the legitimacy of them, and they weren't talked about. And then this guy, William Peter Blatty or Blady.
Yeah.
The Exorcist.
It's a great book, man.
See, I haven't read it.
It's a fantastic book.
I bet it's great. But he's kind of found out about these events, and I think read some articles from the 40s about them, but I don't know that he really did full research the way you would have done. He just was kind of like, this is crazy. And then he wrote The Exorcist based on this Roland Doe figure. And you know, there's a lot of people have investigated it over the years. Like, they think that they found the person reported their true identity. They think is named Ronald Edwin Hunkler or something like that. And he died in 2020. But apparently this guy, when people would reach out to him, was just like, don't fucking talk to me about this. I don't want to be known.
He hunklered down.
Hunkler, yeah.
He hunklered down right outdoors.
Kind of. But I think that is maybe the main... There's a lot of disputes that came out. Like, even the priest, the attending priest that did the exorcism, Raymond Bishop, he came out and disputed a lot of the claims. Like, he said that the shaking bed, I don't think he said was entirely true. I think he said he doesn't remember his voice changing, like they said, and that... there was some other thing that I can't exactly remember, but there were multiple things that he said where he was like, that was exaggerated, that wasn't true. And so people were kind of like, what? But that same priest that's saying some of this is exaggerated also said he thinks there was supernatural shit going on, and that there was a paranormal, some sort of paranormal activity. So there's, with the Roland Doe, you know, there's no way to know. People dispute it. I think the most logical kind of Occam's razor would be, this kid probably was just mentally disturbed or having crazy hormones going through puberty and was just a shithead. Like, just a shithead kid that just, like, spit on people and was a bully and was crazy. and an attention seeker, right? But there's disputes disputed. Some people think it was real. Some people think so. I just think that's really fascinating.
Well, what you were describing is things where there might be a little bit of truth behind it, a grain of a truth. And then you have people that go and investigate it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, you can't say they're total frauds.
Yep, yep.
But
they dramatize.
They dramatize it for the best people that have ever done that, right?
Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Well, and I wanted to just say was that the difference between Ed and Lorraine Warren's story and this that makes me, like, with the Roland Doe thing, I think I'm torn because the Roland Doe or whoever this was in his family didn't want to profit from it. And if they were lying or exaggerating, it wasn't for monetary benefit. The person who made The Exorcist didn't have anything to do with the case. It was just an author. And so I think the fact that people involved don't want attention, don't really, you know, they don't want to claim that anything, I think that leaves some sliver of doubt. Like, was this real? Was there really an exorcism? Was it mental health in the 40s? But I think
they might have thought it was an exorcism, but it was for real an exorcism.
Yeah, but
it was
just a person. Yeah. And I think that that's probably the case a lot of the time. But that leads me into what you're saying with Ed and Lorraine Warren. You know, there's a big difference between Roland Doe and this family that doesn't want any attention. Then you have Ed and Lorraine Warren, who have profited extremely off of stories like Amityville Horror, for example. Right.
Oh, right. I mean, yeah, they have some of the most famous cases of all, right? There was the, what was it? There was what was inspired, The Conjuring,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And Amityville was before that, right?
Yeah, Amityville.
That was in 76, they go and they start investigating that house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was 76. It was
ironically
5 months after the Lutzes ran out of the Amityville Horror House in Amityville, Long Island, New York, right? But there had been, like, they'd been doing videos and going to hauntings, right? Because Ed Warren would paint houses, like, actually not paint houses, but, like, artistic renderings of houses, the classic houses. And then they would go and see if they could investigate, right? And he'd give them the painting.
It's very kind of
weird
artist vibe.
Can you imagine if somebody painted your house and was like, hey, can we come in?
Yeah, yeah. It's a very weird thing to do.
It's like, what's your name? It's like Adolf Hitler. He was a painter, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just kidding. Or it's like, can I come record a song with you or sing a song? I made a song for you. It's like, what's your name? Charlie Manson.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
You know, it's like, you don't just, like, my point being is it could be any nut off the screen.
Yeah, Ed Warren, that's a pretty.
But that was in the 50s, you know, so. But yeah, they started.
The 50s when they started doing that?
I believe late 40s or early 50s.
Oh, you're saying like them drawing these photos and stuff?
Yeah, like that's really starting cool to go up. Like they were traveling the coast, East Coast, and they were drawing, basically.
And these two basically just what? Both had a super, like, interest in paranormal activity, basically, and just fell in love with each other and gravitated.
Well, so she always said that she was clairvoyant. That's what she said.
Mm-hmm.
And that she could see basically dead people and speak to the other side, and that she was at a Catholic school, you know, and she a place where you live, like seminary. What do they call it? No, that's
right. Oh, that's Mormon seminary.
Well, no, I mean for Catholics too.
Oh, okay, a seminary.
Yeah, but they had nuns. It was a school that was oversaw and taught by nuns, right?
Mm.
And so the nuns said, you know, hey, now let's keep that private. That's none of your business.
None of your business.
You know? But they told her to stuff it down and not to approach it. And then she said, so she was clairvoyant, psychic. And I'm like, well, and then she met Ed during World War II, I think 1944.
Wow.
She met him and he was helping them, like, during a bombing raid. They never said where it was, but it was somewhere on the East Coast, you know,
I guess
they were afraid that they might be bombed. But I'm like, in 44?
Yeah, what?
Anyway, that's what the podcast I listened to said on.
Okay.
But then she meets him, and then eventually he said he grew up in a haunted house. It was actually a freaky story. He said, you know, his dad was a drunk and abusive. The mom was drunk and, you know, would help him sometimes. But He said that his grandfather haunted the stairs, and you would hear his cane thumping on the stairs at night. And he said there was an old woman that had lived there and died, and she never did anything to him, but she would just, at night when he'd turn off his light, he would see her face staring at him from the closet.
Oh, shit, that's scary.
Like, yeah, and he'd tell his dad, and he'd be like, oh, you know, son of mine is gonna, you know? And so it's like, I guess he was more afraid of the father, right? Yeah. So that's where supposedly they met and got their start. But I know eventually, right, yeah, they go in and they start filming and talking about their investigations. And one thing I thought was ridiculous is where there's a cemetery near where they lived in, I believe, New York, but maybe you can fill this in. And so basically, they said, oh, there's this lady in white that haunts this cemetery, and we got her on film. And they're like, well, let us see it.
Yeah.
No, no, we can't.
Of course.
Yeah, only we can see it. I was like, oh, okay.
Why? What was their reasoning?
Because
he's cursed or something?
I don't remember. Yeah. It was, no, it was just like, oh, no, we can't show you that for different sensitivity sake or something.
Okay.
And then they would be like, if you didn't see what they saw, he's like, oh, well, that's because you're not tuned into the psychic universe or whatever.
Okay.
So you can't see it.
Sure.
Well, so they would use that later, the Amityville investigation, but then, right, they did Annabelle.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, it's not some freaky, cadaverous-looking doll. It's just
looks
a fucking Raggedy Ann doll.
It's not nearly as scary.
No, it's not scary at all.
Yeah, yeah.
I still wouldn't touch it because you never know.
I'd like to thank our sponsors, Funky Soul Coffee. That's soul with an S-O-L. It's the brainchild of Michelle Russell and Gavin Butler. These two had a dream, and that was to turn a 1976 Airstream camper into a coffee shop, a 70s-themed coffee shop, and they've succeeded. Michelle Russell has years and years of experience in the coffee industry, and she's come up with some truly delicious 70s-themed concoctions. I've had the privilege of tasting a few of them. You can reach them at 208-447-9044. You can email them at hello@funkysoul.com, and you can find it on Instagram or at www.funkysoulcoffee.com. Give them a try.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it would be scary to go to their museum that they have,
right,
or whatever, with all their supposedly paranormal objects and things like that that they took. From every case, they would take one thing, you know what I mean, that they felt like had some sort of symbolism,
right,
to the case, you know, so...
Well, and then they would claim that they were keeping it for safe, you know. The way they're depicted in the Conjuring universe, right? It's not like they're these perfect couple that are, like, basically exorcist fighting, like, you know, yeah.
Well, I mean, Lorraine Warren made, like, a legal agreement with them to, like, leave out a lot of stuff about them, basically.
Oh, yeah, like, he impregnated a girl.
Yeah, a lot of the
stuff. He had liver around.
Yeah, yeah, like, a lot of the weird allegations towards Ed. Probably a lot of the
And he would beat
shit.
Lorraine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and even wanted it to be like never show Ed and Lorraine having an intimate relationship on screen, apparently. Like, wanted to be like never show Ed and Lorraine having
sex
or anything like that.
I mean,
that.
They dance in a
sure,
scene, right?
Sure. So it's like, I wonder why Lorraine didn't want that.
Because they want them to look pure, and then it hypes up the evil, which works, you know? I mean, my favorite of all those movies is The Nun, just because of the way it looks.
I haven't seen The Nun, but I've seen the clip of her, like, where you see the face and it almost looks like it's a painting, but it's really
face.
Well, that shit is freaky.
Well, that's in The Conjuring 2, right?
Yeah.
They show the silhouette of the nun, and it goes into the painting and turns.
Oh, my God, that part is freaky.
Right, and then it ends, pretty much.
Yeah, that is freaky shit.
And then The Nun movie comes out, you know, in, what, 2020 or something?
Mm-hmm.
And it was... I thought it was all right.
What was that based on, do you know? Like, what was The Nun?
The Borley Rectory haunting.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know much about that, but... So anyway, that's Ed and Lorraine Warren, and they'd written books. They were well-known before the movies came out, right?
And I'll just say what was interesting, speaking of Roland Doe, the first one we were talking about, because you're saying they got their start in the 40s and 50s, and I guess I didn't realize that, and that because later on in the 70s, they sort of shifted from just paranormal investigators to, like, demonologists, demon experts, and that was
influenced
because The Exorcist was so popular. Because The Exorcist came out in 1971 and was this huge
and
deal.
And Satanic Panic, too.
Yeah, and the Satanic
Panic.
That's
what people were more afraid of.
Exactly. So both of those things coincided, built the Satanic Panic, and Ed and Lorraine Warren, like, ran with that and became demonologists, demon experts.
Well, because we're forgetting that the, you know, You had The Hills Have Eyes, another Wes Craven movie, yeah, and Glass House on the left. Those were all super, like, disturbing movies.
Yeah, hell yeah.
And then you have The Exorcist come out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was all during the Satanic Panic and Manson family stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, The Hills Have Eyes is actually based on a crime in Scotland that happened in, like, the 1600s. This mutant family that will all, like, have sex with each other and then kill local people and eat them and shit.
Oh, my. It's a real story.
Yeah, it's based on, I forget the name of the family, but it was in Scotland in the 1600s. And they actually had to, like, form militia units to go kill this family that lived in the hills.
Holy shit.
Cave systems.
Wow.
And that's The Hills Have Eyes. He just made the genius move of being like, hey, we have all these radiation bombings, like test bombings. We're going to put it up in the hills where they're all deformed and having, like, mutations and shit.
See, that's what I'm saying about history influences fiction, right? Like, the fiction, Hills Have Eyes, I would have never known had any correlation to a real event in any way.
Right. I mean, tons of stuff does. Like, you know, we all think, like, oh, here, George R. R. Martin created this world.
Mm.
Well, he kind of did. But he's also, that's all based on the diabolical nature and manipulativeness of, you know, court intrigues in the great courts of Europe.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's basically what it was like.
Yeah, that is super smart. I mean, George R. R. Martin does do, like, so much social commentary and commentary on government and things like that. That's super interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, so, yeah, I mean, the Warrens are kind of in the midst of a lot of these things, these stories we're talking about.
Haunting in Connecticut was another
one. Haunting in Connecticut. Yeah. Annabelle, The Conjuring.
Well, The Conjuring franchise, which is Annabelle, multiple Conjuring movies, The Nun, right? There's, like, and they're coming out with The Conjuring 3, The Devil Made Me Do It, which you were telling me about. Is that Devil Made Me Do It case?
And I'm waiting for The Crooked Man. He was like a pimp that terrorized. He's like kind of like a candy man.
Almost like, does he almost kind of look like Slender Man a little bit? Like,
kind of. Yeah, but he has, like, he's kind of freaky looking, but he sounds like he was kind of like a Candyman type guy that, like, haunts an inner city, black inner city neighborhood.
God, Candyman was a great movie. The new one, did you see the new Candyman with Jordan Peele, that Jordan Peele produced?
No, because I like the original one.
Dude, you know what's funny? Opposite. I have not seen the original, and I've only seen the new one, and I need to see the original. But you would, I bet, really like the new one. Anyways.
I you know, maybe I should. But, okay, so yeah, we got Exorcist is kind of this origin point. They get into demonology.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then, so, we go into the 80s, right? Well, the 70s, right? So, my movie of choice was, again, involving the Warrens, but that's not necessarily why I did it, was The Amityville Horror.
Mm-hmm.
A great book.
Very famously
by Jay Anson.
A true story, obviously.
Right. True story. And again, the Warrens were involved. You know, the book sold like 3 million copies. I forget how fast, but really fast.
Who wrote the book? Do you know?
Jay Anson.
Okay.
And then it became a movie quite, you know, so the crime that happened where the DeFeo family murders that happened at 112 Ocean Avenue.
Mm.
Now they changed it to 108 Ocean Avenue because they had so many people were flocking to it after.
Oh, really?
Right. But they basically, the DeFeo family had lived there since 1965, and the whole family was murdered by the oldest son, Ronald Jr., or Butch DeFeo.
Butch.
Right. And so they said, oh, demons made him do it. He said that, all these things.
He even claimed that? Like, he was...
Yeah, until the end.
He's saying he was hearing voices in his head and shit like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
But he was on drugs, and he had...
People hear voices in their head who are mentally ill sometimes, so...
Well, and he had a lot of reason to be, and we'll get into that in a second, but... And then what you had was you had the Lutz family move in right after the murders. Literally, like, murders happened November 3rd, 1974, and the Lutz family moves in on, December 18th, 1975.
Okay.
So not even a year later, right?
And they know, obviously, that there was a murder that took place in the house, like, less than a year ago.
Right.
Just kind of fucking weird that you would just want...
Just over a year.
Or whatever, but just you want to move into a house where, like, this very recently brutal ass murder took place. You know what I mean? That's
right.
I mean, I guess some people might be into that kind of thing, but
they said they didn't care, and that's how they sold it. Like, they wouldn't be the type of thing to bother us. And so, you know, right from the bat, off the bat, there is a bunch of bullshit that they say about the house, you know, and later, if you look more into the Lutzes, you realize that they were contriving or pretty much inventing this situation because they knew of the murders and they were desperate to, you know, make some money and support their family.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, you learn that the lawyer of Ronald James or Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr. was actually in on the creation of a story.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because of what happened in the house.
Oh, wow.
And you had an author that didn't end up writing the book. And they all concocted a story over wine, essentially. And it starts with the origins of the house, right? And so, you know, this is probably one of your preeminent movies that's based on a supposed true story, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, there are movies that are classic horror movies. We'll come back to the...
Well, how much do you think is truth of Amityville? From what you've read, like, how much do you feel like is true?
Jack.
So the murders were obviously...
Well, the murders are true.
So why it was haunted, quote-unquote, was real.
Right. And, right. But parapsychologists and actual serious parapsychologists went in there with scientific, you know, like, all sorts of monitors and recorders and everything mm-hmm.
Investigators use and shit.
Yeah, best technology of that day and time. And they were like... You can't go off of what Ed and Lorraine Warren are saying, because the only thing that was caught in their investigation of that place overnight was what they said psychics saw. Mm-hmm. And all the psychics that were there, except the other than Lorraine,
yeah,
were invited by the Warrens.
Yeah, and that's fucking weird. And haven't a bunch of people in that case, the Amityville case, come out and sort of said that this was exaggerated, this was bullshit. I never saw that. I never happened. And but Ed and Lorraine were kind of two of the people who really kept that going as long as they could, right? They pushed that lie or that story harder than maybe some of the other people who were involved.
Yeah, originally they were going to have a parapsychologist with a doctorate, you know, Kaplan, I think is something Kaplan. He was going to come in and he was going to do it, but he said, if I find that, you know, there's no grounds for to, you know, support your story, I'm not gonna fabricate anything. And so they got rid of him. That's what, you know, his people say. And they brought in Ed and Lorraine because they had heard of them.
Okay.
Right. And so they're like, they will do it.
And were Ed and Lorraine pretty well known at this time?
Yeah.
So like I guess
they were, for sure,
in the paranormal community, I would assume, right? But when did they become famous? Like, was it the Amityville book that took them to that level of, like...
Well, that was a big one, but there was also a guy named Hans, not Zimmer, that guy.
Hans Zimmer, no. Great composer. Hans something.
Yeah. Oh, man, it's gonna drive me crazy. But he wrote a book, and it was a bestseller, just not on the same line as the Amityville Horror was. But, I've read some of his books, but he was well known, and they were well known for their books. I know that. And they'd already been on television and things like this. But from what I understand, this was a huge one.
Yeah.
And this made them big. Book. Right. Yeah. They had already done some things, but this was huge from what
I understand. Had anything made into a movie at that point, or it was probably, what was the first, I don't know if you know this, but I wonder what was the first movie adapted from an Ed Lorraine story that became...
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, this one, they were involved with this case, but they weren't in the movie.
Oh, so they're not in the Amityville movie at all? They're not
mentioned? No, they're not. It ends with the family running away.
Okay.
In the night, you know, and obviously there's the...
Did they make money off of the book? Like, did they profit from the Amityville horror story at all?
Ed
and Lorraine?
Not that I know of, but they wrote their own books and things.
Oh, okay.
Right, and articles, and they would be on things. So it was definitely a
publicity. They still profited thing. Off of it at the end of the
day. Oh, right. Yeah, for sure.
And were probably brought on, I know they were brought on as Hollywood consultants for a lot of these movies, right?
Well, for sure, yeah.
Lorraine, so that's where they're probably making a lot of their money, too, is people like, I can't even remember the director of Conjuring. He's a really famous...
James Wan,
yeah, like people like that.
Yeah.
Consulting them for movies and stuff.
So yeah, there's that, but just real briefly, let's talk about that one movie that you looked into that because the Amityville Horror has a lot more to say, but quickly, one that people might not know was based on history was Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
Loosely, but I mean, there's an origin that's in a real thing.
Yeah, and you actually might know just as much or more than me about this because I didn't get as much research on it as I wanted, but I didn't realize when I was, you know, looking in what are movies based on a true story, right? We're doing the initial research. They said Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? Well, he talk about one of the most trippy, hallucinatory, just fucking weird, like dreamy, literally dreamy fucking movies that you've ever seen. You're like, there's no way that's true. Well, there's actually a fucking, what do you call it? Syndrome or whatever that happens basically, what called sudden arrhythmic death syndrome or SADS. And it's sudden unexpected death of adolescents and adults caused by cardiac arrest. But it's just people just dying in their sleep, essentially.
Right, but it affected the Hmong community, right?
What's your refugees?
Yeah, yeah, and it was in California, some of it?
Yeah,
right?
Or most of it? Were these Cambodians, Vietnamese?
Cambodians, I believe they were Cambodians that came away from, and then also like in Laos, parts of Laos. I think it was a community that wasn't just in Cambodia, but a lot of them came as refugees from the Cambodian genocide that was occurring with the Khmer Rouge, right, up until 75. So they had come over. And so a lot of them, as I listened to, they had beliefs in, you know, the supernatural.
Oh, yeah.
That didn't jive with American kind of like, you know, norms back in that time.
Sure. Different religions and stuff.
Right.
Like that.
And so they had these very real beliefs that, okay, like if they weren't around their culture and the things that, you know, from religion to traditions and customs that they would, you know, live out. One thing was that they were prone to evil spirits that would come in your dreams.
Mm.
And one of the ideas, some of the things they say, there was a boy who died of it early on after his father did. And he was trying to keep himself up all the time.
Hmm.
And there were some other people that would do the same thing. But one of the things that was described in one of these bad dreams, they would have nightmares often.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was that there was somebody chasing me. Some kid said there was a man chasing them.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was in the one that, what's his butt, Wes Craven got the idea from. Was in like 1981 in California, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
or 77, I think, actually was when it started in with the Hmong refugees.
Well, it started then, but I'm talking about when Hans or Wes Craven got the inspiration. Okay. Was a certain case where there was a kid talking about how somebody was chasing him in the dream.
Okay,
but the reason they said these guys died and had been seemingly having nightmares was they said that there was a doctor from. Was it UCLA? It was some sort of, you know, pretty like prestigious university in California, and he was a doctor of, you know, anatomy and all that. I think he was a surgeon, but he was investigating, you know, the physiognomy of these guys that died.
Okay,
and so you blend that with psychology and their beliefs that there is actually, like, where I'm watching The Exorcist, I'm going, I don't believe in that.
Yeah, sure.
But somebody who has that belief and their heart's beating like that. You know, it's a different physical experience for them.
That's a really good point.
And so they're saying that these guys believe that perhaps they're away from the protections of their homeland and the customs. And so in there, when they go to sleep, it's different than me having a bad dream. And so these guys sit there and they're like, oh, this shit's really happening. And so at night, their heart rate is going crazy.
And they don't want to sleep, obviously, either.
So right.
These people are trying not to sleep.
And so they're taxing their hearts by trying to stay awake, what they're taking, speed and coffee and all that. And then they're having these horrible nightmares.
It's crazy.
Based on some of their beliefs and the beliefs that they weren't necessarily safe in America from these supernatural things.
Mm-hmm.
And then turns out that a lot of these guys, and I think there were over 104 deaths that ended up happening up into the late 80s.
That's so weird.
And one of the main things that a lot of these guys shared was that their hearts, the connective cord, I guess, that like comes from the nervous system and it connects to the heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's connecting the brain and the heart. The fibers on this part of the heart were they were deficient.
Wow.
And so they're almost like burning out.
It's like a battery run.
It's like a it's like the wire on a battery, like fraying.
That's insane.
And where we have more fibers in that connecting cord, they had less. And so they ended up dying from this malfunction in their heart.
Wow.
And that it was a genetic defect that was passed down through generations of these Hmong, you know, descendants.
Wow.
And so, like, it's very complicated, but once you explain it, you're like, oh, okay, there is something physiological about it.
That's so amazing, and it's like, so bizarre that it becomes, it's weird that there's a medical explanation for it, a scientific explanation, but that it has this superstitious stuff around it, right?
Right.
When it's happening to these group of people, they see it as some sort of supernatural or superstitious or religious or cultural, you know, thing.
Well, I think it was also tied to some sort of real killer.
See, I didn't know that.
Like his burnt out face. I do know Wes Craven was like,
maybe. Yeah, yeah.
I don't want a Jason. I don't want a Mike Myers.
Gotta go.
Right. I don't want a Leatherface. I want somebody that's different, where they're not wearing a mask. They're the actual skin. He's this burnt dude. So he was trying to do something totally different.
Mm. He succeeded.
Man, he succeeded. Yeah, I remember Freddy Krueger freaked the shit out of me when I was a kid, man.
Do you know that I don't know how true this is, because I heard this in a video about Nightmare on Elm Street, but the name Freddy Krueger, apparently Wes Craven's childhood bully was Fred Krueger.
Right, Fred Krueger. And so he would make him like, I forget what else, he included them in other movies
too. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So like, I just wanted to throw in the, for good measure, to talk about Nightmare on Elm Street, because it's such a classic, but I think really one of the founding horror movies. Like, you had The Exorcist, you had The Hills Have Eyes, but as far as something like, oh, this really happened, right? It was the Amityville Horror, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's all based on, you know, a real place, a real things that happened, sort of, right? Now, one of the claims that Kathy Lutz, one of the people that moved into the house after the DeFeo family was killed with a Marlin rifle, like they were all shot.
Oh, fuck.
By DeFeo, Ronnie DeFeo Jr. But one thing that Kathy said after, in an October 2000 interview, she died in 2004 of emphysema, and he died in 2006, George Lutz. But Kathy Lutz said, coming back to 112 Ocean Avenue, the families that I found had resided in that dwelling place and appear to have a calamity within each one. So basically, she's saying, like, you know, each family that lived there before and after had a calamity. And so the guy who had lived in Amityville before had played in that house for many years of his life with people that lived there prior, okay, the families. His name was Jim Cromarty. Well, he bought the house in like 77, and they had to move out because all the people that came, right? They owned the house until, what, 87 or so? But he said that they lived somewhere else and had somebody watch the house for much of that time because they couldn't live there.
Wow.
Because all the publicity. And that
is that house still there, by the way? Like, you could still go?
Yeah, but it's been drastically altered and its address is different.
Okay.
But he said, Jim Cromarty said, and that is another crock. The Lutzes say that every family that was brought up in this house had bad things happen to them. You know, he's like, that's a crock. It's bullshit. And so Kathy Lutz did say that. And Jay Anson, his book, the writer's book, The Amityville Horror, basically says that the property was cursed.
Okay.
Because many things. So Hans, now, of course, I forget the name again.
This Hans guy we keep trying to fuck him.
Right. I did find it. Hans Holzer is his name.
Okay.
And I read his ghost stories as a kid, his scientific ghost stories. But basically what he said is that it was an Indian burial ground, as he put it, for the Shinneco tribe, basically. Okay. But this tribe doesn't even live anywhere on Long Island, basically. You know, it's the Minnetonka tribe. It's their land.
Okay.
And their traditional homeland. But they said, you know, before, like in the 1600s, 1500s, all the time before, that this was a burial ground where, 112 Ocean Avenue is.
Yeah.
But they're like, no, they wouldn't bury people there, and they wouldn't bring, the other claim was that they would put their, as they said in the book, insane, right, people there to die.
The tribe did?
Right.
Oh.
And so one of the claims is these are angry spirits from the tribe. And when you look at the history, you're like, oh, man, that's kind of some racist shit, as if the tribe's this horrible group. Like, no, it was the wrong tribe you're talking about. And basically, no, they were very kind to their sick and their poor and their people with mental problems.
Really?
Right? And deformities is well, they used terminology in the articles I read.
Sure, sure.
The authors used in on, you know, so old Hans, you know, was Hans Holzer. Was full of shit. And it turns out that he signed a contract to have his book turned into a movie. It never happened, but his book was super popular. Oh, it did happen. It was the Amityville Horror Part 2.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so part of his thing was he would...
They made into a movie, I'm assuming.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the Amityville Horror 2. Too. And so the thing he's saying is that he signed these documents or signed a contract saying... You know, he wouldn't disclose any of the true facts of the case. Wow. Or refute what they said in his book.
Okay.
And so he says, oh, claim to the end of his days that this was an Indian burial ground, as he says, and that it was an angry chief that haunted the area and that possessed Ronald DeFeo Jr. And he shot them. So it was the tribes that, you know... did wrong.
Yeah, it wasn't the white people.
How fucking horrible was that?
Fucking crazy, actually.
You colonize this area, you kick out the tribes or kill them.
And then you blame this nasty murder on
right.
them. Yeah, that's fucking crazy.
Hey there, listeners. Are you tired of driving around in a car that doesn't shine? Let me introduce you to Idaho Express Detail. Established in 2018, this local gem in Boise has been transforming vehicles and leaving them sparkling clean ever since. With a stellar 5-star rating, you know you're getting top-notch service every time. Whether you're in need of a quick wash or a full detailing service, their expert team has got you covered. Located at 515 South Vista Avenue, they're just a hop away from giving your ride the makeover it deserves. And don't forget to follow Idaho Express Detail on Instagram for amazing before and after shots and special promotions. So why wait? Treat your car to the best. Swing by Idaho Express Detail today and see the difference for yourself. Do you struggle with sleep, stress, or mental fatigue? Discover the power of Sarasate, a revolutionary, non-invasive neurotechnology that helps your brain rebalance and reset itself naturally. At Sarasate, they use advanced brain technology to support your brain's own ability to relax, reset, and restore. Their safe, proven approach has helped thousands improve their sleep, reduce stress, and enhance overall well-being. Imagine waking up refreshed with a clear mind and renewed energy. That's the difference Sarasate can make. Whether you're dealing with insomnia, PTSD, or just everyday stress, their personalized sessions can help you find the peace and balance you deserve. Visit Sarasate.com, that's Ceresete.com today, to learn more and schedule your free consultation. You can also reach them at 208-779-1040. Discover the natural way to a healthier, more balanced you. Attention, book lovers. If you're looking for more empowering literature, welcome to The Lit Room, a beloved feminist bookstore in Garden City, Idaho. They specialize in women's literature, indie and small press gems, and a fantastic selection of works from local authors. The wonderful owners Chelsea and Megan are passionate about fostering a welcoming space for all readers. But that's not all. The Lit Room is expanding with a brand new book bar. Imagine sipping on a delicious beer, surrounded by shelves of captivating reads, all while unwinding in a cozy atmosphere. Visit them at 215 East 34th Street, Garden City, Idaho, and discover your next favorite book. Don't forget to follow them on Instagram at This Room Is Lit for updates, events, and more. Support local, celebrate women, and find your next read at The Lit Room.
Well, so the other thing that was said in the Amityville book, and then the DeFeos, not the DeFeos, the Lutzes would use, is that there was a witch that lived on there.
I heard this one.
Right. His name was John Ketchum, you know?
A male witch.
A warlock. You know, John Ketchum, who had lived there. He had come.
Wizard.
No, wizards are good. Well, no, they're not.
Well, because I just think
that's why Sauron's
Harry Potter, aren't they witches and wizards?
Yeah.
So yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
You know, but you know, warlock is the technical term.
Technical.
But then, you know, like Sauron's a necromancer, whereas Gandalf's a wizard.
Okay.
Yeah.
Necromancer, I like that a
lot. He can bring back the dead.
That's dope.
Yeah.
That's like some Aleister Crowley shit.
Right.
Aleister Crowley. That'd be interesting.
Mr. Crowley.
That'd be a fun one to talk about.
Did you speak to the dead?
What band is that again?
That's Ozzy.
Ozzy, for sure, for sure.
Sorry,
cut you off.
No, that's fine. Yeah, we can always talk about Ozzy. Yeah. Now, if Ozzy had lived at, you know, Amityville.
Oh, God.
God, it would have been great.
Oh, God.
You know, wouldn't it? It would have been wonderful. So anyway, Jim Cromartie, who lived there after, said, you know, I was born in Amityville. I knew every family that grew up in this house, and that is another crock. The Lutzes say that every family that was brought up in this house had bad things happen to them. It happens to be a fact that the only one family had a tragedy that happened to them in this house. Every other family had nothing but good things come out of the house. Hmm. And so in the 1600s, you know, it was part of the Huntington Township, which is a rough 13 miles away from the small village or hamlet of Amityville. And so there were Ketchums that lived in the area, but the Ketchums that are descendant of those Ketchums had done tons of genealogy, and there was never anybody accused of being a witch. So that's another one. And so there's a lot more to that. But basically, there was an older house on the property at one point. And, you know, so the first people to own it were a family that were called back to the original property and the people that actually built the house. There had been families, it had been farmland, but they were called the Ireland's. And
love that name.
They were very, the Ireland's. Where are you from? Scotland.
Yeah, you're like, what?
Wales. We're English. You know, fuck the English, you know,
damn it.
They were a very influential farming family. But anyway, they started to build the house in 1924, right? And so it was a Dutch colonial. It's still there today, like we said. But when their home was being built, the Moynihans, who had bought the land from the Ireland's, the Moynihans bought the home, basically lived in the old house. And that had been moved down the street that had been on that site. Now, Kathy claims in one of the documentaries I saw that was also haunted.
Okay.
No, it wasn't.
Sure.
The people that live in there never had any bad experiences. And so the Moynihans moved into the house in 1925 when it was finished, you know, and then they sold it to somebody else. You know, the Rileys bought the house, in 1960, and then they divorced, so there had been families living there, is my point, down the chain. And so it was the Rileys that sold the house to the DeFeos on June 28th, 1965. And so the DeFeos were basically picture perfect on the outside, right?
Mm.
But there were always questions. Now, Ronnie Jr., right? Ronnie DeFeo, Butch, they call him. He was the firstborn son in 1951.
Okay.
And he was much older than the other kids. And so he was the firstborn son of, Big Ronnie DeFeo is what they called him, right? And Ronnie DeFeo was the father, and he sold cars. Mm-hmm. So people are like, how the hell did this guy, you know, afford this beautiful mansion on Los
Angeles? So he was a criminal, I'm guessing, right?
Some say he was.
Just the fucking name. Dude, you didn't even say that.
I know.
Big Ronnie DeFeo. I was like, this guy's clearly affiliated.
And so, for instance, he got, later on in the 60s, this car salesman who bought this huge house, he spent $50,000 back then on oil paintings of his house by a great artist.
Huh.
And $50,000 just to drop like that in that time. What is that now?
So today's money.
Right.
Shit.
And so his son said, he was very loving when he was doing right, but when he could also just turn on that like a dime. And witnesses from the family say that they saw him slam Ronnie up against the wall.
Fuck.
You know, and Ronnie was a heavy guy. you know? And so, like,
so you're giving reasons why he might want to kill his family, right? Or kill his
right.
parents.
Well, yeah. And so, you know, the love that was doled out to his other family, you know, who knows exactly why he did it. Ronnie never really got into it too much.
Really?
But the thing is he starts on amphetamines in the 60s as a teenager because he was heavy and he wanted to earn his dad respect. And his dad was kind of heavy, too.
Wow.
But anyway, he starts
Big Ronnie, right?
But then, so he starts taking amphetamines and he loses weight.
Mm.
And so a lot of his drug problems.
Before Ozempic, baby.
Yeah, right.
Amphetamines.
Boy. Yeah, and so anyway, long story short, he gets addicted to drugs. He loses the weight. But he also has psychological problems because of the abuse he suffered from his dad and whatever. So, you know, the other kids would get kind of the brunt of it, or not the brunt of it, but they would get some of it. But I think Ronnie caught the most hell. And so, yeah, on November 3rd, 1974, you know, he basically runs down to a bar down there. And he says, oh, you know, I just found my parents shot, right? You know, what am I to do, you know? And so, come with me. He was all distraught, as one would be, obviously, when, you know, your whole family's been killed. And so the guys from the bar come back there, and what do they find? They find the other members of the family, right? They find Don, Mark, let's see, Don, Mark, I had written this down, Allison and John. John had been born in 1965, so he was 9 when he was killed. Yet Mark was born in 62, yeah, so he was 12 going on 13. Allison was 13 going on 14. Don was born in 56. So he shoots them all. There have been accusations that Ronnie slept with Don. I don't believe, most people say it wasn't true. But anyway.
That shit is so disturbing to think about killing
right.
people like that young.
And Louise DeFeo had... basically left him, what, in 61 or so, Big Ronnie, because of abuse and things, infidelity maybe.
Okay.
But then he got her to come back by influencing, he wrote a song and he had a well-known jazz musician from New York record it for him and then give it to her.
Mm.
And so, yeah, he does have this idea of like, hey, you know, you play in my clubs.
Mm.
Why don't you come down and record this for me?
Dude, you do a great Vito Corleone impression.
Yeah, you know, this is, what can you do for this? And this is the day of my daughter's wedding.
Marlon Brando.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I like Brando in Apocalypse Now. Like, you know.
He put cotton balls or grapes right? in his mouth to play Vito.
Yeah, right.
That's what you do. You disrespect my family.
Yeah.
I saw gardenias.
You know, the end of
it. No room an offer. You can't refuse.
Right. That's good. So, yeah, he's kind of like that. And anyway... Yeah, so on November 3rd, Ronnie's watching a movie I've seen, actually, a rated R World War II film, where the whole, like, everybody gets killed in the end. It's called Castle Keep.
I've never heard of that.
It's a great movie.
Okay.
But he's sitting there watching that, and he said the whole family was in bed, and this Marlin rifle was handed to him by a figure with black hands, and it said, kill your family, and he was powerless to stop. And he goes in and he shoots his parents, you know. Now in the movie, they'll show like the mirror breaking, but I've looked at some of the crime scene photos, and Ronnie, a big Ronnie is laying in bed face down. They're all face down. The mother's covered in, so you don't see.
Like, flip them over.
He made them flip over.
And then she'll.
Yeah, and so he shot his dad in the back. All you see is a bullet hole with blood trickling down it. You don't see, like, guts everywhere. So that they play that up for the movie. It's a good movie, but... and then he goes and they find everybody face down, but he kills his siblings. And I guess they said, oh, he was shot in the head, but no, the mom wasn't shot in the head. She was shot in the chest, basically, in the stomach. And so, like, in the movie and in the book, he's like, oh, you know, the mother, Kathy Lutz, wakes up at night screaming like, she shot me in the head, or he shot in the head. But that isn't what happened. She got shot in the heart, right?
Just...
Well, from the back, right?
Yeah.
And so what we do know is that later Ronnie Jr. would say that he had basically Mark flip over. Mark, one of the brothers, was awake, and Ronnie told him to flip over on his face and shoot him, right? And so that's what happens. And so...
Or it makes me think... It honestly makes me kind of sick thinking about it. Like, it's
right.
Just thinking about that people do these things, you know?
Right.
It's disturbing. It's disturbing.
And so this is sometime... Yeah, this is in the evening. And, you know, later... I think it's, what, around 9 o'clock or so. And so he runs down to the bar, the local bar, just at the intersection of Ocean Way or Ocean Lane that they lived on, and then another cross street. And he runs in, and it's a bar he had gone to, so they all know him. And he's like, tells his friends, this is what happened, you know, they're all dead. And so anyway, they come running, and they find the adults, or the kids.
People that he told?
Right, yeah. And they find the kids, and then they call the police. And I think it's pretty apparent to the police, they found ammunition in his room. It's not like he tried to cover it up very much. And so, like, Han...
Told people about it.
Right.
For Christ's sake.
And so he would talk to Hans Holzer, and this is where they have the demon argument come in, basically. He was like, oh, I was possessed by demons, you know? And so this is what the Lutzes kind of come in with. So this had been in the news. The Lutzes knew what had happened. And so they think, they come in here, and they like, okay, so the idea is that they know what happened there.
Hmm.
So they, whether it's true or not, they did know. Mm. And so they say, well, that's why we didn't believe in the supernatural, but then all of a sudden all this stuff is happening, right? And so, you know, all this stuff is happening, so they say, but they do know what happened. So I think what happened is they knew about the murders. They read that Ronnie said he was possessed by something, and they said, well, here's something we can do. And that's, in fact, what they did. And... his name's the last name Weber, but he was the lawyer for DeFeo, right, Jr. And he sat with an author that never wrote the book, and the DeFeo or the Lutzes in their house, and they came up with an idea for the story over glasses of wine. He said, and so later. What, in 1977, 78, 79, somewhere in there, he had a trial. He sued them after they sued him.
The author that
didn't write
it? Okay.
What, the lawyer.
Oh.
Okay. He's like, I came up with these ideas. What are you trying to do? You got to give me some of the profit.
I see.
You know? And so he said everything was concocted. We came up with the flies that would gather on the windows. And so some of what they would say is like, okay, they buy the house. They know what happens there. And so they enter the house on December 18th. And the idea is that a priest comes in, basically, and he cleanses the place. And so I'm going to go through this kind of, I found the Amityville murders, and it was some of the research that was done for this book. That kind of refutes. It's called The Night the DeFeos Died, and it's by a guy who's now dead, but his name was Rick Asuna, and he studied this for decades, and he wrote this book. And so he just went through, and he said parts of it are just discounting facts, what they said were facts. And so, yeah, we went through the history here. He said many Indian groups lived along the tidal bays in the area, but as far... as the claims about Native Americans are made by Jay Anson's book, the Montaukett Nation basically says it was all a hoax because of what we said earlier. You know, they have an amazing oral history tradition, and that's how they keep their histories in most Native communities. And he's like, they talk about everything. And he said they do. In these oral traditions, they understand that the Montaukett, and they had the wrong tribe anyway, took care of their sick, dying, and mentally insane, and even showed the European settlers into the area in the 1600s how to do the same. The other thing, he said a witch named John Ketchum escaped from Salem, Massachusetts during the witch trials and built a house on or near the famous Amityville house. Worship the devil, right?
Wow.
And he said, no, a prominent citizen named John Ketchum did returned to Long Island after he had left to Ipswich, Massachusetts. But he was just a dude. He was a representative of government. He was basically a farmer, kind of, and he was just a regular guy. You know, so they just, that's bullshit. The other idea was that it was on a cemetery that was cursed. And they said that there was actually a Amityville and New York Historical Society investigation in 1913. And a historian named William Erdely was commissioned by New York to copy down old cemetery and Bible records so that it could be preserved as things, your resources and sources fell apart and cemeteries became neglected. And he said these cemeteries were either moved or relocated to bigger incorporated cemeteries. And he said there was never in any of this research, any report or indication of a cemetery being anywhere near that property. Wow. So all that original stuff is whatever. One of the things that they said was that there was a particularly evil room under the stairs in the basement where the, you know, a lot of the things happened to the Lutzes, right? And so this was supposed to be, as they say in the movie, the gateway to hell. And it's just a freaky room.
Yeah.
And whatever. And that's where the flies assemble. And this man that is shadow figure made of flies. And there's a pig creature that the daughter sees of the Lutzes named Jody. And it can be a teeny weeny, you know, like teddy bear sized pig, or it can be a giant size of the house pig.
Jesus.
But basically it says that comes from the red room under the stairs.
Huh.
And that has a pit in it, which is the gateway to hell or the underworld or whatever. Well, yeah, it says, so the facts about the red room was that it was nothing more than a little area underneath the stairwell that the DeFeo children sometimes stored their toys in or used as storage. It no longer exists since a subsequent owner has renovated the basement and built over it. Author Rick Asuna was granted access to the home before publication of his book. The basement had, indeed, underwent an extensive renovation. Absent was anything remotely resembling a red room or supernatural room. So a myth.
That's almost weird that they renovated it, though, and they got rid of it. They're like, this shit's right. Freaky. Let's fucking cover this
but,
shit.
I mean, it was just, like we have under our stairs. We got a fucking storage area, dude.
Yeah.
It was nothing more than that. American International Pictures, the myth is that when they made the Amityville Horror, it couldn't be filmed in the real house because the crew is too scared and crazy things happen there.
Okay.
Now, the fact is the village of Amityville viewed the ghost story as a hoax and did not want a film crew in the sleepy community, so they denied them shooting permits. So they couldn't go in there.
Wow.
No pun intended, shooting permits.
Oh, God.
Oh, man. Okay, here's a myth. Kathy Lutz has three dreams in the Amityville Horror about Louise DeFeo. First, Kathy says she wakes up screaming in the house because she saw that Mrs. DeFeo died by a gunshot wound to the head. And here's the truth. Kathy wakes up screaming, she was shot in the head. And this is in the movie. A second dream is that in the novel, Mrs. DeFeo's body was being removed from the DeFeo plot as St. Charles Cemetery, where the rest of the DeFeos are moved, and she was moved to Brooklyn. That's not true, apparently. And the last dream of the novel is Mrs. DeFeo making love to a painter in the DeFeo portraits, who had drawn the DeFeo portraits. So the fact from the book and the movie is Mrs. DeFeo died of two gunshot wounds to the upper body and not a head or neck wound. Even though Louise DeFeo's head seems to have blood splatter on it. Second, the Brigantes, who was Mrs. DeFeo's maiden name, right, her family, never moved Mrs. DeFeo's body because she wanted to be with her kids, right? They wanted her to be with her kids. And lastly, there's no evidence of an affair. Mr. DeFeo constantly checked up on Louise with a red phone. That only he knew about and the number, right? So he would use that and make sure that she was home. He's off with his guma.
I was going to say, so you know, again, criminal.
Yeah.
Very criminal.
Like Tony Soprano.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so there's that kind of stuff, right? And then some of the other ones are Okay, so the Associated Press basically said Kathy concocted a nightmare idea about Louise DeFeo. And so, okay, that was, let's cut that part out. Okay, so here's another one. In the movie, a 250-pound door flies off the front of the house, tore off its hinges. And they say this happened, the Lutzes did.
Yeah.
And that there were hurricane power, like hurricane speed winds.
Mm.
Meteorological charts and data from that day, that the time period they're talking about, show nothing remotely like that. And it was rather that what actually was torn off, and they had proof of this, they had pictures on this website, was a screen door where wind will do that on, man. It's still on the bay, right on the river. Yeah. So that's going to happen. And so the other part is the Catholic Church is hiding evidence that something existed in the Amityville house. That's the myth, right?
Mm.
And that they show in the movie, like they're trying to silence Father Ralph Pecoraro. That's the real name of the father. In the movie, he's like Father Munucasco or something like that. But
father as in priest, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yep.
And that he came in and blessed the house and almost died gagging on flies and sweating. And it's this
in the movie?
Yeah, as this evil thing killed him, like was slapped him and said, get out.
Okay.
Well, he maintained for a long time that it was actually, you know, something did say get out.
Oh, okay.
But later, in a redacted statement that the daughter of the DeFeos got the information, because, you know, she's like, it's my right to know because I'm the daughter.
Hmm.
They showed that the priest said in his testimony on oath that, yeah, nothing happened. He never even went in the house.
Holy shit.
He only talked to them on the phone.
Holy shit.
Right? And so that's how the whole story starts, really, is the priest goes in and all this crazy shit ends up happening.
And none of that happened.
Right? No, none of that happened. And so the fact is that Father Ralph Pecoraro admitted that his only contact with the Lutzes was a phone call. Questions remain whether or not he even ventured near the famed residence in Amityville. The assistant to the Vicar General of Rockville Diocese, overseeing Amityville, on May 15th, 2002, sent author Rick Asuna a letter stating their position. In short, the letter stated, the diocese maintains the Amityville horror is a false report. And in March of 1979, Anson addressed the inconsistencies in his book, saying, yeah, I know the physical research people say I made mistakes. They say that on such and such a day, it didn't rain and it did rain. So what? I am perfectly normal human being. Sometimes I make mistakes. But this is just some of the truth and mistruth. But basically, the idea of the story is they move out 28 days after moving in on, they move in on December 18th, 1975, a short time after the murders, relatively speaking. And that they see one of the police, they say, sees a boy in the corner of the room that shows where to find evidence, you know, in the corner of the room where there's a box of bullets. Maybe it wasn't really that hidden, right? That one of the other things is that, you know, right from the start, she starts being touched by something. And when she does, she almost passes out. You know, there's things like, you know, the dog would scratch the floor in the basement where the red room was, and the way they found the red room was busting through a wall. No, they knew it was there. Mm-hmm. It was hidden behind a bookshelf, I guess, something like that, but it was nothing so dramatic, right? And definitely it just wasn't a pit of hell where, you know, James Brolin is the actor in the 1979 movie. He basically falls into the hill sludge that is supposed to seep out of the toilets and on the walls, right? That never happened. Right. They say that there's a picture of a ghost boy, but there's even questions about whether that is true. And that was taken, they say, by the Warrens. Right. They say all that happens. A priest comes in. That never happens. But that priest continually has problems and is so ill. There are lingering side effects, including when he actually tries to stand up for them and have a mass at a church for them. He goes blind.
Wow.
Well, he was sent away from the diocese there later because the Catholic Church is like, based on how you acted with this, we can't have you doing certain rites and being a priest. This is all questionable.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, so that was what he was doing, and everything about it. I don't have the time for it all, but there is a, you know, there's so much. There's that, just like the DeFeo, like, you know, there's a connection. Like at 3:15 a.m., Mr. DeFeo or Mr. Lutz, George Lutz, would wake up in the middle of the night, you know, like shouting and freaked out. Right when the murders happened, 3:15 a.m. is when it happened.
Oh, God, okay.
Right? And
3 a.m.
Yeah, so it wasn't 9 p.m. like I said earlier. No, it was 3 a.m. It was way early. And how, then the other thing is that I wonder, and I don't know if maybe somebody out there has the answer for it. Why is there a bar that's open that early? He kills him at 3:15 a.m. and then rolls to the bar.
Yeah. And why are there people there?
Or did he wait for a space of time and then run to the bar the next day? No, because they first find the bodies on the 3rd, the same day. So he kills them on the 3rd in the morning, and then they find the bodies.
There's shit even about the murder story.
Right.
It makes total sense.
Right. I mean, there's so many things. And then so the Lutzes said that they knew Father Pecoraro for many, many years, or like a couple of years prior, and gave them marriage counseling. The first time they ever met him, that they said when they were sworn on oath during the Lutz versus Weber disagreement or lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
was that they had met him, you know, right when, if not after, they had gotten married.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they'd known him for a month. There's just so many discrepancies. Everything leads to, okay, these people, they left the house, but that many believe was contrived, that they thought, okay, we're intentionally doing this,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Well, it sounds like right. all this shit was contrived.
Right, and then here's the thing.
Basically,
that,
everything you said that was cool about the movie
right.
didn't happen.
Everybody that lived after in the house after said that the only thing they want is privacy.
Yeah.
So much so that the people who lived there, the Wilsons were the last family I found that bought it in 97. They changed the fucking windows to squares so it doesn't look like eyes.
Like
so people don't recognize the house. They covered up a pool that was in the backyard.
Wow.
They put on a sun house. And so basically... nobody after said anything bad happened in this house. Nothing remotely
bad. Nothing paranormal.
And they said the best testimony they can live to the for the victims is to live basically in peace in this house, you know?
Yeah.
So who knows if there's stuff there, but the Warrens come in and they investigate in 76 after the Lutzes didn't like who was they originally connected with as a paranormal researcher.
Mm.
And so there's television crew there. There is some psychic researchers from, you know, an actual institute, even though some people laugh at that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a professor there of some sort from some university. And there are the Warrens and the psychics, quote unquote, that they know.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is, well, the psychics saw stuff. They talk about a black shadow entity that when they're in their state of psychicness, I don't know, comes rushing at them.
Mm-hmm.
And they also say that they feel evil there, that Mr. DeFeo, Ronnie, Big Ronnie is there, and he's so malevolent that they can't come back to the house.
Hmm.
And that was all PR. The Warrens were brilliant at PR.
Yeah, you know, the Warrens are...
And so this movie goes on, and it works. Their plan works. And so Jay Anson writes this book. You know, they get a huge cut, the Lutzes, right? The Warrens can put this on there like, oh, my God, you know, can you believe this? They wrote things about it, right? Hans Holzer, who is also, he comes in because the Lutzes, or another family brought him in Ronnie DeFeo Jr. and his lawyer have him come in, and he investigates the place. But they all basically concoct bullshit, right? Because they're profiting off of it.
Yeah.
Even the lawyer who has a, you know, he's like, no, this really happened. He's saying this really happened because he's pissed that the Lutzes got more money and credit than he did.
Yeah.
Right? And so they're all like, and Ronnie holds on to that, I did it because the devil made me do it kind of thing. Up until, you know, before he died. He dies rather recently, 2018, 2021, somewhere in there. But he finally... he starts saying the truth, and he doesn't want anything done or will give none of his permission to anything being done about his story that says that he was possessed. So he totally changes his argument. He's like, you know, the guy fucked me up. My dad fucked me up and I got crazy.
That says a lot. Wow.
Right.
It's crazy.
So basically, the Warrens cash in off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Hans Holzer cashes in off of it. The Lutz is cashing in off it. And I mean, the only victims here are the family and the survivors of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge movie. It made $80 million in 79, right?
Jesus, yeah.
And I mean, yeah, Star Wars made $400 million.
No, but this is...
Which is huge, but this is...
Totally different thing.
That's still really good for horror.
They'll make as much money as science fiction.
Checks, you know, it obviously...
It's a rated R movie, There's only two rated R movies that have ever made $1 billion, and it's Deadpool and Joker. So that should tell you right now.
The new Deadpool?
The new Deadpool and Joker are the only two rated R movies.
Well, the new Deadpool's Trump in like all movies.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so that's kind of like there's a lot more to that. There were lawsuits. The church finally, like I said, admitted that it was all bunk. But all the evidence heaps towards the Lutzes being frauds and knowing that they wanted to capitalize off of it. And they did. But they both died. They divorced. Kathy died of emphysema. The kids were kind of fucked up by these.
Did any of the Lutzes come out and say it was fake or anything like that?
No, I think the kids are quiet about it. But again, I'm no expert on this. So, you know, if you guys do want to look more into it, the Amityville Murders .com is a great website. It has all sorts of the research. Yeah, AmityvilleMurders.com. And it's based on this book that I kind of want to read. That kind of went into refuting a lot of this stuff. So that was The Night the DeFeos Died by Rick Osuna. And so I also read articles from the Day and Age. There were some good housekeeping articles in Good Housekeeping that other people wrote. several books. Shit, like over like 10 or more movies, right? One, the remake with Ryan Reynolds, right? And... you know, anyway, there's a lot to get mixed up in, but this is one of your foundational kind of horror movies in general.
No doubt. One of the most foundational.
Right.
Yeah.
And it is a frightening movie, you know. I believe in the pig demon Jody.
Ed Gein is another one.
Let's talk about Ed real quick.
We don't have a ton of time to talk about him, but I would say that Ed Gein was... one of the more influential real... I mean, we're talking about horror films like Amityville that... we're kind of saying didn't happen, or even The Exorcist, like a lot of that shit didn't happen.
But Leatherface.
Yeah, Leatherface, I'm wearing the shirt right now. Ed Gein.
Oh, yeah, and I'm wearing my Michael Myers.
Totally, like, Halloween-themed, but...
oh, Michael.
Ed Gein is, like, probably, people don't realize, the most influential serial killer on horror and, like, creating other famous characters. People like Norman Bates in Psycho and the Bates Motel are based off of Ed Gein. Leatherface in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, really?
Based off of, he's also based off of like three other serial killers too, but he was one of them, Ed Gein. And then if you've seen American Horror Story, the show, the second season is Asylum. Zachary Quinto plays a serial killer. That's such a great show. And his character was like,
what show is that?
American Horror Story is what it's called.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
Season is a new thing, you know.
I stopped watching it after like the maybe the vampires or
I stopped watching it too. But Asylum was the second season.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Great season. And the Zachary Quinto's the doctor who's the serial killer,
right?
That's based off of Gein, because Ed Gein, you know, long story short, because I can't go super into it, but was basically this guy who was fucked up. I mean, his mom was fucked up. His mom basically sexually abused him and raped him and taught him to not fuck with women and that women were scary. And like his whole sexual reality and how he learned about sex was from his mom. And he had this...
There's weird, a problem.
Yeah, like weird fucked up obsession with his mom, like obsessed with his mom, but also equally traumatized by his mom. And you know, that's where the Norman Bates influence comes from, because Norman Bates is, you know, dressing up like his mom and killing people in Psycho. And then Leatherface, you know, uses people's skin as like a mask and things like that. Ed Gein was basically would fashion. He was not just a serial killer, but he was a corpse exhumer. Like, he would rob graveyards.
We all need hobbies,
right? Yeah. His hobby was going and robbing graveyards, and he would take body parts from bodies, and he would like fashion lamps and like fucking furniture around.
Have you seen the movie Maniac? Oh, dude, that's
based on that.
That's in this. That's like an early '80s, late '70s movie.
Is that happening?
And it's in a gritty, dirty New York. Yeah, he hunts people, and he kills them in New York, and then he makes like he scalps women, and he'll put their like hair on mannequins, and he'll stuff women. He'll like taxidermy.
Story. This is just a movie. You're saying
it might
be, but it's probably based off of him.
Oh, dude, it's a crazy movie.
Or Ed Gein. That's what I'm saying. Like, Ed Gein, like, that movie even probably influenced it. It sounds like Ed Gein, for whatever reason, not that Bundy, other people have been incredibly, Zodiac, there's a lot of people that have been influential on fictional serial killers, but I would say, from what I've read, Ed Gein influenced some of the most famous made-up fictional serial killers that we have in film. You know, I think that... Oh, and I was going to say, in American Horror Story Asylum, Zachary Quinto's character, the moment you find out that he's the killer is when the main girl, I can't remember her name, looks over and sees a lamp and it has nipples on it. And it's like she's seeing that the lamp is like fashioned from skin. And then that's when it clicks in for the audience that this whole time you trusted this guy and this guy was the fucking killer the entire time.
Wouldn't it be funny if like you look over and it's like a big cock and balls?
I mean, fuck.
That's my Schlanger lamp.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if he had dad issues, that would happen.
Can you imagine a Schlong lamp?
Oh, my God. I don't even know what the fuck Schlong lamp.
It'd be like a desk lamp for college students.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
You know, it just hangs over, like, the light comes from the tip of the beep.
Oh, no.
Beep.
No. This is not good.
That's why I don't design. No, don't cut
it.
Don't cut that out. You got to keep that in.
All right, I will. That's so funny.
You know what? I don't know if you got any. I don't have any concluding remarks other than, yeah, that Amityville story was big. There was a lot to it, and I don't even know how I summed it up.
You did well. You summed up a lot of it. Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot more to it. It's just huge. It's like, it deserves, like...
Well, all of these, probably there's a lot more than what we're saying. I mean, some of these we covered very briefly, and so it's like, you could probably have a whole episode on...
Amityville could be a whole series.
Yeah. I mean, Ed Gein could be a whole episode, right? I mean, so...
Eddie G.
Yeah.
Man, what about, the clown, Casey?
Ed Gein is, like, one of those guys who actually was truly, like, mentally, clinically insane. Like, he died in a mental institute, not in a prison.
Bring in the clowns. That's AC, right?
Okay, yeah. What's his name again? No. John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not the John Wayne we all think of.
I think one of the American Horror Story, there was another season called Freak Show that was about circuses and stuff, and they had a character that was a clown, I think, that was probably largely based off of Gacy, too. So, a lot of these famous serial killers and a lot of these famous horror movies like we're talking about are based off of or very loosely based off of either real serial killers, real hauntings, real events, or even fake ones like Ed and Lorraine coming up and exaggerating things. So I just think that that's a really fascinating side of horror.
All right.
Yeah, right. That there's, you know, you watch these movies thinking, oh, they're bullshit, but there's at least sometimes slivers of truth to
this. Well, people always said, oh, you know, Dexter's the bad guy. I'm like, what?
Yeah,
I think he's pretty cool, man.
Killing the bad guys. I don't care if you're killing bad guys.
But he had to fight that lust to not kill normal people.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, and it was weird how in that show they did a really good job in that show of showing how some people don't have emotions.
Oh, right.
Like how he genuinely had to pretend he had emotions and would have to pretend he loved his wife or like pretend, or maybe he really did start to have feelings. I can't really remember, but he would basically have to pretend he loved his sister and like have empathy and things like that.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was funny and scary at the same time. But, you know,
anyways, if you
want to know more about murders and crime in Boise, go to idahistory.com and look up our tours. That's pretty much all we got at this point. We got you come on this van that if you go to the YouTube,
you get to come on
channel,
the podcast studio.
No. You get to come in here. You get a drink beer too. I drive you around. We go to sites where crimes happen in beautiful Boise, Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
We go to some bars. We go to an old rotten house where a murder happened long ago. And and then on the walking tour, a macabre history of Boise. We walk around the downtown core and talk about all sorts of wacky shit and history. So do check that out, idahistory.com. I am Mark Iverson, and my illustrious colleague is
London Talbot.
and we are Highway to History. And if you think that's a play on Highway to Hell by AC/DC, you'd be exactly right. So namaste.
Cool. Thank you, guys.